can exert over a pipe.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. I'll begin with a featured article. Henry Winkler breaks the curse of stardom. Now in his 70s, the pop culture icon has found his true calling on Barry as the king of character actors. There's a very dramatic close-up picture of him right next to the title. When the producers of the HBO series Barry asked Henry Winkler to audition for the role of Gene Cousineau, they assured him that he was on a short list. Winkler said he was willing as long as the list didn't include Dustin Hoffman. Because he's a movie star, he'd get it. If Dustin was on the list, I wasn't going in. They said no. I said okay. There was no particular reason to think the two-time Oscar winner would be up for the same part, but Winkler can be forgiven for indulging in a little paranoia. Across the span of his 50-year career, he's had some highs, the 1970s pop culture saturation to rival Star Wars and the music from Jaws, and lows, including a long stretch where he couldn't get hired, filled with the sense that he'd been typecast into oblivion. Barry, co-created by and starring Bill Hader, is about acting, or more specifically, about a depressed hitman who comes to Los Angeles to murder someone and decides to give up acting, to give acting a try. He joins a class taught by Gene, a washed-up name-dropper. He makes restaurant reservations as Neil Patrick Harris, who has covered the walls of his acting studio with posters of plays he produced, directed, and starred in, including a gray-haired turn as Peter Pan. Inside his classroom, he's a legend, a sometimes gifted teacher, ragingly sincere as he spurs his students to find their voice. In the real world, he's just another out-of-work actor, one with such serious anger management issues that he was barred from attending Patrick Swayze's funeral. In a scene that Winkler performed for his audition, Gene is running a class in his black box studio, instructing his star student Sally, played on the show by Sarah Goldberg, to dig deeper. Hader and his co-creator Alec Berg watched Winkler work his way through the scene. The part had originally been written as some kind of drill sergeant, but Henry had this instinct to console her, Berg explained, and even when he tried to be mean, he has such an inherent warmth. Berg and Hader started pushing Winkler himself to dig deeper. You really need to go after her, Hader told him, like if you've ever been angry at a person and you just want to hurt them. You want to take her down so you can build her up. It's how you manipulate these people. Oh, Winkler said, so this man is an asshole. Yes, Henry, Hader said, you're playing an asshole. With that, Winkler locked in on the character and the scene became more interesting. In the episode as it was finally broadcast, Gene is in a fury and Sally is on stage. Sensing a false performance, he shouts an expletive. He says it again, cutting her off as she stumbles through her monologue. She tries to defend herself. Excuse me, he says. I don't give an expletive. Even your excuses are false. You're up there. You're stinking up my stage, babe. What the expletive do you want? Finally, she mumbles, to be an actress. Again, I don't believe you. Tearing up, she says, it's all I've ever wanted in the whole world. Oh, really? Gene says. He turns his back to her and faces the class. Oh, yeah, last week she takes me out for a cup of coffee, starts to cry, snot running down her nose. All of a sudden she says, I'm not going to make it. I'm telling you, I was embarrassed. It was pathetic. Here is a person who's spending her money. She doesn't have any talent whatsoever. This chick shouldn't even be in this class. I cannot believe. That's not fair, Jean, she sobs. And now, having shredded her defenses, Jean turns back. And in a flash, the hostility's gone. He's only been acting. And he gently, kindly implores her, "Don't think," he says. "Just finish the scene." It works. Sally's performance is utterly changed. It's raw and alive. And at the end of the scene, Gene hugs her, tells her he loves her, apologizes for his methods, then turns to the class and says, "I want you to create a life right here on this stage. I mean, we're not here studying some expletive TV commercial acting. That's not why you came to LA, is it? You didn't move all the way from the country for that. This is the theater." Winkler crushed it. After the audition, Hader turned to Berg and said, "He just made the part better." Berg told me, "If we had cast what was on the page, we would have ended up with a much smarmier, darker monster. But the balance of warmth and pathos that Henry brings to the character through his performance, and also just through who he is and what people know about his life story, is so consistently perfect with the vibe of the character that they lie on top of each other very nicely." When other actors did the scene, it was pretty vicious, Hader told me. When Henry did it, it felt more personal to him, like he could have been talking to himself. Barry mercilessly mocks the plight of actors, but it also takes the work seriously, defending acting as a calling, as a way to address despair, and as a technique for transformation, change. Watching that first season made me rethink Winkler's whole stage strange journey. It was a gutsy move for a man who had been struggling to land a great dramatic role for 35 years, to play an actor who can't act, trying to teach great acting. And, in a miracle of art imitating life, imitating art, it paid off. Winkler won a Primetime Emmy after the first season, 42 years after his first nomination for the award. And in 2019, the second season went on to become HBO's most watched half-hour show. I first met Winkler in the fall of 2019 before anyone knew that Barry was about to go on a 2-year COVID hiatus. It sounds like a long time ago, but as I stood beside this icon of my own distant past, looking up at the apartment building on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where his parents moved in the 1940s, it felt like a long time ago even then. I wanted to meet there so we could talk about Winkler's rotten childhood. Winkler suffers from severe dyslexia, which was undiagnosed until his early 30s, and he talks openly about his lifelong struggles with reading and math. He even co-wrote a popular series of books for middle school kids about a plucky little boy named Hank Zipzer, who lives on this very corner and whose days are filled with comical disasters caused by his differently functioning brain. Winkler is the son of Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany, and in his talks in schools and bookstores, he always mentions them. The kindergartners like when I do their German accents, and the older kids like hearing how mean they were, he said. The combination of his dyslexia and family history make for an interesting pathology, marked at once by shame and determination. One way he copes is to stay busy, to make himself useful, to work. So on that warm fall day, he flew to New York from his home in Los Angeles to promote his latest book, the first in a new series for children called Alien Superstar, about a blue-skinned alien with 6 eyeballs who is mistaken for an actor in costume. Our meeting had been squeezed between radio interviews, a book signing in Scarsdale, appearances on the Today Show, and the Tonight Show, and some school visits. He noted some changes to the building's exterior, then stepped back and pointed to the window of his childhood bedroom, the place where he hid from his parents' rages and danced alone to the music from West Side Story, rehearsing the moves from memory while dreaming of a way out. He recalled the moment nearby when he accidentally stepped into traffic and was grazed by a van. The driver carried him into the building. As we walked away from all the heavy emotion down 78th Street, he pointed out the stairwell where he had his first kiss. the Chirping Chicken on Amsterdam Avenue that used to be a drugstore, the fire station where he once knew the firemen's names. At the corner of Amsterdam, a mail carrier called out, "Mr. Henry." Winkler returned the greeting, then put cash in a homeless girl's hands. Receipts fell out of his wallet, and he chased them down the sidewalk. He got stuck at the door of a bakery, holding it open for a woman with a stroller. Then a second stroller pushed by a woman who stared at him as he waved to her kid. All these babies. Then he went up to the counter and accidentally cut the line. After realizing what he did, he had ordered his slice of pound cake by then. He apologized, introducing himself, asking the young couple he cut in front of their names and the origins of their names, then paid for their order. "I had coffee in my last interview," he said, as we sat on a bench at a bus stop by PS 87, his old elementary school, "and now I'm flying out of my shoes." He opened the bag and started eating. As people came into the bus stop and stared, Winkler greeted them and offered his seat. He was a little jet-lagged and apparently hungry, doing his best between bites to answer my probing questions about his early trauma, although it was almost impossible to hear his replies over the clatter of jackhammers. Winkler's father, Harry, a cultured, commanding little Napoleon, was fluent in maybe 6 languages and used more than one of them to berate his son. His mother, Ilse's weapon of choice was a hairbrush. Winkler recalled a morning at breakfast when he clowned over a bowl of Rice Krispies, then cowered as his mother leapt to her feet to attack him. After he figured out what they thought of him, he did his best to tune them out, which eventually turned his living room into a war zone. "I learned to squash a lot," he told me at the bus stop, "but eventually you can't squash anymore because there's no more room to squash." His parents had so narrowly escaped the Nazis when they left Berlin in 1939 that even one day later, Harry's brother tried but could not get out. He died in the camps, as did most of their extended family. Harry smuggled out the family jewels because he knew they were never going back, but he led Ilse to believe that they would be heading home soon. She missed Germany and suffered from depression, and when Winkler was born in 1945, she had a nervous breakdown and was institutionalized, though he wasn't sure exactly when or for how long. "It's all hazy," Winkler says, "and I didn't like them to the point where I never asked them a question." He and his sister Beatrice were not close until years later, and he recalled with dread their fractured home life, the somber mood at the dinner table, the lack of praise and laughter and kids' art on the walls. His academic failings and learning disability added to that pervasive feeling of sadness at home. He didn't have cool friends and was always on edge. But in 6th grade, he saw the Moiseyev Dance Company in Madison Square Garden, and it took his breath away, the music, the bodies in flight. At 13, he saw West Side Story, then went back 10 more times. "My emotionality inside was always bigger than was appropriate," he said. "Man, oh man, maybe a life on the stage, on the screen, would be large enough to contain him." Winkler recalled how, as the credits rolled and the overture swelled, and an actor like Albert Finney, Jimmy Stewart, or James Dean came on screen, he would get a feeling as if he'd been hit by lightning, a raw, electrified desire to be that guy. Watching the climatic scene in Rebel Without a Cause, as Dean sobs over Sal Mineo's lifeless body, Winkler fell in love with the way physical motion alone could communicate such a deep feeling. Years later, he learned to rehearse his lines with an awareness of the repetition in his movements, using sense memory and muscle memory as a way to work around his dyslexia. Winkler's dyslexia still makes him feel anxious and embarrassed, he told me. and it affects almost every interaction. Dyslexics are used to encountering obstacles and working around them, but the disability doesn't improve over time. He has trouble decoding his own handwriting and following maps and schedules. He can only remember left and right by thinking about which elbow hangs out the window when he's behind the wheel. Stacy Winkler, his wife of 44 years, told me that he managed to drive past the gate to their house once or twice a week. On Winkler's first network TV job, a guest shot in the 1973 episode of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, the cast broke for lunch, and Winkler didn't know where to go or know whom to ask, and swore to himself that he would never, ever let that happen to another person he was acting with. Although it did take him many tries, he eventually passed geometry and graduated from high school. At Emerson College in Boston, he nearly flunked out several times, but played the title role in Peer Gynt. In 1967, as a senior, he auditioned for the Yale School of Drama, hoping to one day make it on Broadway. But on his way to his audition, his anxiety spiked, and the monologue he memorized from Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona flew completely out of his head. So he invented a monologue that sounded Shakespearean, really sold it, and got in anyway. James Naughton, two-time Tony winner, remembers meeting Winkler in their first year at Yale, describing him as this sweet, young-looking guy with a ton of energy. "I get a big kick out of the fact that he's playing an acting teacher," Naughton said of Winkler's role in Barry. He described the destructive atmosphere of their three-year program. "Those of us who survived did it in spite of our teachers." He remembered a single incident where he and a partner received praise for their technique. "Wait, what? Someone actually said we accomplished something?" It's sort of built into the system, breaking you down, criticizing you, and making you feel like expletive. Winkler also recalled the abuse he took at Yale, imitating Stella Adler, scoffing as he tried to open an imaginary gate to walk through his imaginary garden, and Norma Brustein losing it when she caught him taking notes in class, accusing him of undermining her authority, criticism that would one day come in handy for Barry. "I wasted my time, not by being a student, but being so nervous," Winkler said. "I was like a hummingbird flapping my wings to stay up. I didn't mean to be defensive. I tried to stay open. I took notes, but I couldn't spell, so I couldn't read back my notes because I couldn't tell what the expletive it said." At Yale, Winkler's ambition and relentless work ethic rubbed some of his classmates the wrong way, and they coined a slogan for him: "I want instant international recognition." He described himself as that toy that you punch. Bozo goes down, comes back to center. That's what I did. Jill Eikenberry, another classmate who went on to star on L.A. Law, saw signs of that determination during their second year when Winkler appeared in a production of The Physicists, a 1962 play by Frederick Durrant. The play opens with Winkler's character, a patient in a mental institution, having just murdered a nurse. "It was really kind of shocking," she said, "because I saw this person who was so clearly not Henry. And how did he know how to do that when we were just newbies? He had found something or revealed something. He was this nice Jewish boy from New York," she continued, "mysterious and dark and interesting and weird. There wasn't any of that, but the mysterious parts came out." At the end of their three-year program, Winkler and Naughton were asked to join the Yale Repertory Theater, a professional regional company whose productions sometimes advanced to Broadway. In the fall of 1970, Winkler got his first paying job as an actor, earning a solid review in the Times for a staged adaptation of three Philip Roth short stories. He joined an improv group, tried out for plays, Broadway, movies, commercials, made $10 appearing on a game show, got fired from a play in Washington, D.C., had one line on a soap opera, delivering a telegram. He made it to Broadway in a play called 42 Seconds from Broadway that closed on opening night. I decided at that moment I was not just going to be on Broadway for one night, I'm going to make this work. He landed a movie job driving a Mafia Don's limo in Crazy Joe, a gritty 1974 New York crime picture starring Peter Boyle. It wasn't much, but then came a bigger role with Sylvester Stallone in The Lords of Flatbush. Things were happening for Winkler. He felt conflicted about doing commercials, about heading west, about auditioning for TV series, but he moved to Los Angeles because a representative at his agent's office said it was time. He rented a room in West Hollywood next door to a belly dancer, and 5 days later won that guest spot on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. A week after that, he got a guest shot on the Bob Newhart Show. 2 weeks later, he read for the Happy Days pilot. Scripted television was going through a revolution in 1973, and Norman Lear was at the center of it. He pretty much owned the realistic comedy genre, starting with All in the Family, and was already dealing with gender inequality, cancer, rape, impotence, gun control, homophobia, and teenage alcoholism. Happy Days, produced by Gary Marshall, offered an escape from all that. Set safely in Milwaukee in the 1950s, it dodged the big issues of the day and instead told the heartwarming story of the Cunningham family and their teenage son, Richie, struggling into manhood. The studio wanted a motorcycle gang to balance out the family, but couldn't afford one. So Marshall, who had adapted Neil Simon's The Odd Couple for television, wrote the character of Arthur Fonzarelli as Richie's swaggering sidekick, basing him on tough guys he grew up with in the Bronx. "I thought I wanted a tall, handsome blonde," Marshall wrote in his memoir, and in walked a short, dark-haired actor from Emerson College and the Yale School of Drama. Winkler was already sweating through his shirt when he walked in, but he transformed his body and his voice, and although his part was 6 lines long, he got Marshall's attention by forcing his scene partner, who was standing, to back into a chair. When he finished, he threw the script in the air and sauntered out. And 2 weeks later, he beat out Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees for the part. He accepted it on the condition that he be allowed to show the emotional side of the Fonz, this indestructible greaser whose face easily flickered with concern, making sad little dinners for one in his dingy apartment. Happy Days was a nostalgic, soapy comedy about high school kids making out, driving hot rods, and working in the family hardware store. A review of season one recommended it for 7-year-olds, and the usual substratum of catatonics who are afraid to do anything else on Tuesday nights except watch television. But it became a hit, and despite a scarcity of lines in the first season, Winkler's tender-hearted, lusty, defeated car mechanic became the breakout star. In the second season, Happy Days was up against Lear's African-American family sitcom Good Times, and Jimmy Walker's catchphrase, "Dynamite," had caught fire. Marshall, pushing to make his show bigger and faster, urged his cast to use wardrobe, gestures, and easy-to-imitate lines, because TV fame in the 70s depended on it. "Book 'em, Dano. Who loves you, baby?" As the writers moved the Fonz to the center of the show, and they hit number one in the ratings, and then fought to stay on top, Winkler's naturalistic approach to a humane, domineering, goofy, self-pitying wrench head was subsumed by his catchphrase, "Whoa, an A." I was 10 when Happy Days came on the air, and not the most discerning viewer. I thought Link on the Mod Squad was the coolest guy on TV, with Kwai Chang Kane of Kung Fu as a close second. But the Fonz was hard to look away from. He was ironic and emotional, the tip of his tongue pressed between his teeth when he dialed the phone, and his voice broke when he returned impish, shrieking, "The Fonz wants to dance." A glow of radiant affection beamed out of him for his surrogate mother, Mrs. C. The Fonz could be generous, self-absorbed, loyal, and neurotic all at once. Sometimes the case when the longer a show stays on the air, the stupider it becomes. Over the next few seasons, the writers granted the Fonz increasingly bizarre powers. He danced the Kazatsky, jumped his motorcycle over 14 barrels, controlled the very animals of the forest. He played Hammond, played the bongos, kicked and punched doors, walls, cars, and the jukebox with magical results. He dressed like Elvis and sang Heartbreak Hotel. He took on saintly powers, lecturing on racism, desegregating Richie's band. Season 5 began with a Baroque three-parter in California that ended with Fonzie jumping over a shark on water skis, giving rise to the phrase, "Jump the shark." "I'll admit," said Ron Howard, who played Richie Cunningham, "I never fully understood the tone of that show." In an interview in 2006, he recalled sitting on the set during the shark episode, flipping through the script. "It was a jumbled mess," he said. "We all thought it was a little ludicrous." But Winkler's character remained central to the story. Even his castmates tired of the hysteria surrounding him. In her memoir, My Days, Happy and Otherwise, Marion Ross, who played Mrs. Cunningham, recalled, "It was not Henry, but the character of Fonzie, whom we all at times resented, because he sucked the air out of everything associated with the show." Winkler struggled with his own weird experience of the monster he created. At the height of it, he met Stacy and her son, married Stacy, had two more children, and traveled all over the world as a superstar. But he couldn't help wondering, in a more essential way, what it meant. "That character got through as early as age 3, he said. I had children come up to me and say, 'Hey!' It was amazing. I'm not kidding. And half my brain knew this was a good thing, a pragmatic thing. This was keeping the show on the air. And the other half, I never let in, someone telling me how much I meant to them. Because I realized early on nothing about me had changed. I was still short. I still couldn't spell. I still had trouble reading. Being a star didn't fix any of that." By 1984, Happy Days had been slipping in the ratings for 8 seasons. So it shouldn't have been such a shock when it was finally canceled. Winkler did his impression for me of his younger self at the moment he realized it was over, sitting in his office at Paramount with his head in his hands. "I never thought past this. I've lived my dream. I have no idea what to do." He asked himself, "Will I ever do anything as powerful as the Fonz? Do I do anything less? What do I take? What do I turn down? Oh, that's too much like the Fonz." He desperately wanted to distance himself from the character he helped create. "I thought I could beat it. I was manic about not being typecast. When I met Jed, Stacy's son from her first marriage, he said, 'Hi, Fonzie.' And I said, 'Would you like it if I called you Ralph?' I was already instructing this 4-year-old. It was insane." Think about iconic characters from long-running hit shows. George Costanza, Ally McBeal, Don Draper, Norm, Niles, Rhoda, the cast of Will and Grace, Sex and the City, or Friends. As an actor, you spend years inside that character. You become that character, sort of, and then your show is canceled and it's time to grow and evolve to convince casting directors, studio execs, writers, and audiences that you're someone new. Inadvertently triggering associations to your last gig ruins that. If you look up the word typecasting on Wikipedia, you can read about the struggles of William Shatner and Patrick Stewart. Or you can just watch Galaxy Quest, a movie about a bunch of typecast Star Trek-type actors miserably signing autographs at low-rent fan conventions. after 178 episodes and four films in his Starfleet uniform, Stewart told the London Times in 2007, came to a point where I had no idea where Picard began and I ended. Stewart, by the way, is back with the Enterprise crew and is three seasons into Star Trek, Picard. Happy Days was a blessing and a curse, Bob Balaban told me. Balaban and Winkler had known each other since the 1970s, but it got closer in the spring of 2019 in France shooting The French Dispatch, Wes Anderson's movie in which they play art dealer brothers. Henry is an absolutely wonderful actor, he said, but it took 9 or 10 years for the frenzy over the Fonz to calm down enough so you could put him in something, and he didn't enter into your serious movie and get laughter just because he was the Fonz. Movies are about believing. Acting is about believing. And it's hard sometimes to believe somebody when you think you know them that well. 1977, Winkler starred in the film Heroes, which did reasonably well at the box office, but was widely panned. Vincent Canby called it truly rotten, and called out Winkler's performance in particular as a kind of terrifying bellwether. Winkler brings, quote, to the motion picture theater all of the magic of commercial television except canned laughter, he wrote, adding that it was a frighteningly bad film because it could well be the definitive theatrical motion picture of the future. The critics were just getting started. The following year, Winkler starred in The One and Only, alternates between The Coy and The Cute, Canby complained. And the year after that, an Americanized TV adaptation of A Christmas Carol. Unnecessary and pointless, Tom Shales wrote. The audience that came wanted to see what they liked, and I thought I was being clever person doing something that would not typecast me, Winkler said. When I look back now at The One and Only or Heroes, I see an actor who's limited. I'm no leading man. There's no leading man in me. I'm a character actor. When I asked what a great acting teacher like Gene might have done to help restore the talents of a 36-year-old superstar coming off 11 years as Fonzie, who might have lost focus or intensity or grown stuck in a certain persona, Winkler was momentarily silent. I don't know. I'd have to say, okay, we've got to break you down and clean out all that experience so that you can renew, so that you can build on it. As his coach, I would have him do scenes that aren't necessarily in his wheelhouse, stuff he wasn't comfortable with, and hopefully after months of that, he would break loose of this block of ice and it would start to crack. In the past 2 decades, Winkler has become widely known to generations of viewers who never knew the Fonz. As the wrathful OB-GYN Dr. Lou Saperstein on Parks and Recreation, as the fraudster father Eddie Lawson on Royal Pains, and in his critically praised role as Barry Suckerhorn, the world's worst lawyer, on the beloved deranged satire Arrested Development. Winkler has played such a wide variety of goofy or supporting roles since Happy Days that you might wonder whether there was anything he turned down. 5 Adam Sandler movies, including The Waterboy, in which he played a hallucinating football coach. A murdered school principal in Scream, uncredited. He appeared on both The Practice and Out of Practice, voiced characters on The Simpsons, South Park, Bob's Burgers, BoJack Horseman, and Robot Chicken. Played or voiced Dr. Olson, a Dr. Watts, a Dr. Slocum, and a Dr. Maniac, as well as Uncle Ralph and Uncle King Julian and a character called Nacho Cheese on a show called Uncle Grandpa. He's been involved in at least 6 Christmas movies. He appeared in 58 episodes of the oddball comedy Children's Hospital, without ever understanding what the show was about. And there was that moment back in 1995 on the Larry Sanders Show when Jeffrey Tambor's Hank Kingsley snaps at Winkler, playing himself. You know, you can't just bang on a jukebox and go, hey, and all your problems disappear, Fonzie. Winkler answers, perhaps unconvincingly, worked for me. In September, with the studio reopened, Winkler went back to work, shooting season 3 of Barry, which premiered on April 24th. Before he saw the script, he got a note from Hader. "Uh-oh, you're going to have fun this third season." Winkler recalled it saying, and I thought, what does that mean? Do I end up in camouflage holding a gun? Henry comes to work every day like it's his first day at the rodeo, Sarah Goldberg said. He brings a sense of joy and occasion, and I've never seen that in another performer, let alone someone who's been doing it as long as he has. And he always comes in smelling very good. That's the thing that everybody comments on. You can smell his cologne before you see him coming, and everybody is relieved when they get there. The aroma of Henry is here. Dad's here. Everybody can breathe a sigh of relief. The message in Barry is that you must either grow or die, and that the stage is a worthy place in which to transform, but that it will cost you. It's sad and a little heartbreaking to watch Gene still holding out for his own big break long after he should have quit, hoping for some miracle that will make him a brilliant actor. It echoes Barry's own moment in season 1 when he's forced to murder his good friend, and the trauma of it brings him to an emotional place that raises his performance in Macbeth. Season 3 begins in a landscape of scorching beauty, and we find ourselves inside a nightmare of Barry's making. His only way out is through the guidance of his beloved acting teacher, Gene, who is then pulled inside the nightmare and is forced to kneel in the middle of some wasteland and beg for his life. In this faded light, Gene looks almost burnished, the lines in his face deeply etched as his mostly white hair blows around, staring up at the end of Barry's gun, refusing to submit. There's a depth in his hazel eyes. Since the show began, Barry has been unable to reconcile where he is with where he wants to be. He wants to be a star, not a murderer, and wishes he could get past his unforgivable sins, but he can't. Can't save himself or anyone else. But Gene won't let him give him up. If you want another chance, he says, like a man who really earned it, then earn it. This season is the most intense serial comedy I've ever done in my entire career, Winkler said. There are a lot of things that are hard to watch this season. Hader said, laughing, it's kind of darker. He couldn't stop laughing. The pervading feeling is, you know, wow, Jesus Christ, oh my God. All that stuff you squash, Winkler told me, back in that bus stop on Columbus Avenue, all that frustration, eventually you have to spoon it out. And then you're left with holes inside you from being criticized, from criticizing yourself and believing it. He said somewhat enigmatically, I see myself as a chunk of Swiss cheese, and I have spent the last 5 years trying to fill all the holes so I become a chunk of cheddar. I pondered the cheese analogy and asked for clarification. He said, I'm getting closer. I'm not working at being. I've finally gotten to the place where I can just be. This was the power of acting. Henry definitely had some real tough moments of going to a place that was uncomfortable for him, Berg said, but he did an amazing job. Yeah, you're Fonzie, and then it went away, Hader said, but he did so much stuff, and great things kept happening to him. He went on about Winkler's lovely wife and house and family. This is morbid, Hader said, but Henry's one of those people I sometimes cry talking about, and he's not even dead. But you get sad and go, oh man, this all ends. I think on some level he figured that out. Hader laughed. One day we'll find out that he's got like 20 bodies buried under the house, but until then, I'll be on record. I think he's a beautiful person. The author, Matthew Clam, an interviewer, is the author of Sam the Cat and Other Stories, and most recently, Who is Rich? He teaches at Stony Brook University. And now I'll read the Screenland section of the magazine. Sports betting has become so easy that the sport seems secondary. Did a failure to satisfy our diminished attention spans lead to the gamification of every moment of the game? Story by Jake Nevins. Early this year, as I attended my first ever New York Knicks game, the friendly concessions clerk who handed me my $17 beer before tip-off asked if I'd be placing any bets with FanDuel. The mobile sportsbook app went live in New York just days earlier, after the state became the nation's 18th to legalize online sports betting. Still, the question surprised me. I wanted to say I was at Madison Square Garden to watch the game, not bet on it, as if this distinction made me some kind of righteous purist. After almost a decade in New York, I had adopted the lowly Knicks as my own, hoping to establish with them an allegiance as devout and excruciating as the one I'd had with my hometown teams in Baltimore. This seemed to me to be the most dignified form of fandom, a birthright uncorrupted by capital or by the fact of winning or losing at all. It was not long before these pieties gave way. Within a week, I'd squandered the $50 FanDuel offered me for signing up. More has been squandered since. If you've watched even a few minutes of a sporting event over the last year, you've probably seen the commercials. FanDuel's parent company reportedly spent over $863 million on sales and marketing in fiscal year 2021. Its rival, DraftKings, is reported to have spent a similar sum. One ad stars Jennifer Coolidge as Lady Luck, and she tries to smuggle a leprechaun through airport security. She's spending her winnings on a trip to Bora Bora. Another caters to realists, assuring users that they can cash out of a bet anytime they think it might go south. But the FanDuel spot you're most likely to have seen, the one that makes the strongest case for depositing your money into this treacherously user-friendly app, is the one that promises to make every moment of the game mean more. This ad's seductive premise is that the experience of watching sports will be enhanced by generating more and more financial stakes, with money wagered on as many elements of the process as possible. Which team will win the opening coin toss? Who will be leading at halftime? Whether, say, Steve Curry will make more than 5 3-pointers. Combine all of these outcomes into a parlay bet, and you could win even more. And then the ad speak is to be believed, create more meaning, too. The commercial itself is a dizzying supercut of clenched knuckles and jittery knees, and a vision of modern sports fandom in which the locus of action lies not on the field or court, but on a handheld device. We see one man's eyes widen as he watches his smartphone, indifferent to the game of pool he's playing with friends. Another plants a celebratory kiss on his phone screen. Another swivels restlessly as a barber takes a comb to his hair. Place your bets, the ad suggests, and even the salon might become a site of enrichment. But the commercial also rests on the surprising assumption that sports are often in and of themselves boring. We see two spectators at a baseball game grow cartoonishly long beards as FanDuel promises to make America's pastime feel like less of an endless passage of time. The pro golfer Jordan Spieth appears ready to sink an easy putt. Make golf more, our narrator begins before politely trailing off in deference. The solution to this boredom, sports' failure to satisfy our diminished attention spans, or the modern expectation that we somehow be involved in everything we watch, lies in the gamification of every drop, jab, hook, hit, steal, save, knuckle, meet, as the narrator proposes, pitching a degree of interactivity greater and more remunerative than fantasy sports ever could. These platforms infiltration of our experience of sports goes beyond ads. Only six such spots, for instance, are permitted to air during individual telecasts of the NFL, which was an outspoken opponent of legalized online betting until 2018, when the Supreme Court overturned a federal ban that prohibited the practice in most states. Last year, though, the league announced partnerships with three different sportsbook companies, all the while taking pains to reassure skeptics of the game's integrity. In March, the wide receiver Calvin Ridley was suspended for the upcoming season for betting on NFL games. On NBA pregame shows, experts now advise gamblers on their wagers. Increasingly, betting lines appear on screen during the telecasts themselves. For a time, Uber Eats offered gift cards for placing bets with Caesars. And every Thursday, you can stream FanDuel's half-hour show, More Ways to Win, in which the week spreads and money lines are parsed for optimal value. The studio setup looks familiar, but the operation itself is spiritless, bearing more resemblance to CNBC's coverage of the stock market than to the typical sports show, whose belligerent repartee is familiar to anyone who has ever watched a game with friends. The FanDuel experience is less communal, more customized. I've enjoyed watching my roommate earn the spoils of his wagers, but they more often reflect the failures of my own. In the film Uncut Gems, set in the gray market days of 2012, the gambling-addicted jeweler Howard Ratner charters his mistress a helicopter from New York City to the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut, carrying a duffel bag of $155,000 to place a three-way parlay on Game 7 of the Celtics-Sixers playoff series. More recently, I had to lift exactly one finger, my thumb, in order to lose $10 on a five-way parlay. Sports gambling once evoked casinos, currency counters, and smoky black rooms with college football playing on cathode ray TVs. Now, the experience is brought to us directly, casually, and conveniently. As with so many other things we once had to seek out or wait for, phone calls, pornography, political arguments. When I was young, my father would sometimes ask if I thought the Baltimore Ravens would win their next game. I never wanted to answer. The very act of predicting seemed to me to have karmic consequences, as if I might rankle the football gods. Like organized religion or dieting, this kind of passive but sustained commitment to the franchise of your choice can feel ennobling, and we expect to reap its rewards accordingly, to win a championship or gain entry into heaven, or look somewhat like a catalog model before summer. This, to me, was the point of the whole covenant of faith and fandom itself. But it turns out that with a few clicks and a bit of cash, we can render that whole bargain meaningless. Why stake your mental health on your team's winning or losing when we can contrive for ourselves a cluster of smaller games within the larger one? Games in which we control the terms of engagement, adjusting our loyalties from night to night. Never in human history have there been more ways to win, FanDuel tells us. So many, in fact, that you might forget the cardinal one altogether. And what a strange relief that is when you're stuck with the Knicks. And now, Judge John Hodgman, the sarcastic genius and judicial arbiter. Judge John Hodgman on the pajama catchphrase. A married couple disagrees on a nighttime ritual. Sanjay writes, "My wife recently purchased some comfortable soft pajamas. Whenever we return home from an outing, she immediately runs to our bedroom only to emerge seconds later in her pajamas announcing, 'We be jammin'." I have two issues. One, pajamas should only be worn to bed, and two, her pajamas shouldn't have a catchphrase. could you rule that she can stop both? And the judge writes, marriage is hard, but two great consolations guaranteed in the contract are these. One, the right to dress down, be comfortable, and indeed be so vulnerable in front of another person that no goofball pun is off limits. And two, the right to experience joy, especially in your pajamas. I'm sorry you are unfamiliar with these terms of your agreement. Please revisit the paperwork. Take your time. The rest of us will just be jamming over here. And I'll end with a poem. The poem is by Rick Barrett, selected by Victoria Chang. The older we get, the more life and death tangle. In this poem, the speaker occupies the liminal space of transition, where the child and the parents begin to switch roles. This poem toggles among birth, life, and death seamlessly. It starts with objects remaining after a recent death, and eventually turns to the speaker running errands with his aging parents. This final unannounced shift is what gives this poem gravity. Changes are always happening, and the time's movement is constant. But our awareness of these changes arrives at the most mundane moments. Buying cupcakes at a bakery, or picking up cold medicine at the pharmacy. Of Errands by Rick Barrett. On a table in the living room, there's a gray ceramic bowl that catches the light each afternoon, contains it. This is the room we turned into the room of her dying, a hospital bed in the center, the medical equipment against the wall, like personnel. In Maine once, I rented a house hundreds of years old. One room had been the birthing room, I was told, and I sat in that room writing towards the bright new world I'm always trying to write into. And while I could stop there with those two recognitions of endings and beginnings, I'm thinking of yesterday's afternoon of errands. My father and mother were in the back seat, my sister in the passenger seat, and I driving. It was like decades ago, but everyone in the wrong places, as though time was simply about different arrangements of proximity. Sometimes someone is in front of you, or they're beside. At other times, they're behind you, or just elsewhere, inconsolably, as though time was about how well or badly you attended to the bodies around you. First, we went to the bakery, then the hardware, the pharmacy, the grocery, then the bank. The person who chooses the poetry is Victoria Chang. She's written 5 books of poems, most recently Obit, Cooper Canyon Press 2020, which was named a New York Times notable book. Her book of nonfiction, Dear Memory, Letters of Writing, Silence, and Grief, was published by Milkweed Editions in 2021. She lives in Los Angeles and teaches in Antioch University's MFA program. The author of the poem is Rick Barrett. He's an American poet whose latest book is The Galleons, Milkweed Editions 2020. He directs the Rainier Writing Workshop, a low residency MFA program. Thank you for joining us with the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.